Would you stand with me to pray? And the word from Isaiah 37. And Hezekiah prayed unto the Lord, saying, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, that dwellest between the cherubim, Thou art the God, even Thou alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. Thou hast made heaven and earth. Incline Thine ear, O Lord, and hear. Open Thine eyes, O Lord, and see. Hear all the words of Sennacherib, which hath sent to reproach the living God. Of a truth, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their country, and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were no god, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they have destroyed them. Now therefore, O Lord, our God, save us, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that Thou art the Lord, even Thou only. So may Thy people, O God, renew their confidences in Thee this day. For Thou art the God of the earthquake, the wind and the fire, the friend and the foe, and the voice still and small. And Thou art the God who comes very near in Christ. Amen. We have guests today, and I welcome you who are guests for that annual spring happening that we long time ago labeled the Carver Barnes Memorial Lecture. Southeastern Seminary, we're very proud to have been able to offer these lectures through the last several springs. And it's kind of our way to usher in March and say goodbye to winter and hello to renewal, personally and collectively. We have had the privilege of inviting several persons who really do stand tall in our discipline from across the earth to deliver the lectures, but none more delightful than the lecturer this year, Dr. Robert McAfee Brown. I'll not take the time to present Dr. Brown in full detail because his writings and his career are well known to us on the East Coast. And besides that, you've had an opportunity to meet him through the media that have circulated through the campus and the community of late. So let me simply tell you these brief bits about our lecturer. Dr. Brown is presently professor of religion at Stanford University and visiting professor of theology and ethics at the Pacific School of Religion. I asked him if there were any kind of interesting backgrounds in the different titles that he had at the two schools. And he said, yes, my most recent title at Pacific School details where I am more recently in my pilgrimage, professor of theology and ethics. Dr. Brown was born in Carthage, Illinois. He married a young woman who was born in China, a daughter of missionary parents. They were married in 1944. They have four children. Dr. Brown is an ordained minister in the United Presbyterian Church. It tells me that in the last several months, or even years, he's become increasingly convinced that his future and the future of us all resides in the church as well as in the university. 1943, he entered Amherst College, from which he earned a B.A. degree. In 1945, a B.D. from Union Theological Seminary. And in 1951, a Ph.D. degree in the Union Columbia University program. He has also studied at Mansfield, and at Oxford, and at St. Mary's, and St. Andrews, and has received in an 11-year period from 1958 to 1969 seven honorary doctorates from schools of consequence across this country. Amherst, University of San Francisco, Lewis and Clark College, Loyola University, the University of Notre Dame, Boston College, St. Louis University, the Pacific School of Religion, St. Mary's, and Hamilton. Dr. Brown has published widely And from amongst his publications, you would know best his fine work on P.P. Forsyth, Prophet for Today, published by Westminster in 1952. The Bible Speaks to You, published in 1955. The Spirit of Protestantism in 1961. And the Ecumenical Revolution in 1967, revised in 1969. Frontiers for the Church Today was a very popular book in 1973. And his most recent volume is Faith Obsolete, published by Westminster in 1974. He has translated and contributed to numerous volumes and works, and through it all has had time to be a United States Navy chaplain for 3 years, and an assistant chaplain and instructor in religion at Amherst and at Union, and the Auburn Professor of Systematic Theology at Union Theological Seminary for a fine stint of 9 years from 1953 to 1962. And as I said before, he went in 1962 to Stanford, and in 1975 became visiting professor of Pacific School as well as professor of religion at Stanford. I've told Dr. Brown a bit about you. I've told him that you're a mixed bag. You do have two ears, and you listen, and you look, and you incorporate. And that's good news to a lecturer. So I present for all of us the Carver Barnes Lecturer for 1976, Dr. Robert McAfee Brown.
Thank you, Dr. Lawley, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very glad to be here for these 2 days. I'm going to feel very much home already. I feel very much already in the kind of ecumenical atmosphere. Here I am in a Baptist chapel. We've had this rousing chorale prelude by a Lutheran. You've invited a Presbyterian to speak to you. And I half expected that the invocation would be in Latin. Somebody needs to keep that language alive. Reference been made to the fact that I'm a Presbyterian. I perhaps should share with you at the beginning of the week my favorite Presbyterian story, which is about the young man in our denomination who was appearing before the presbytery to be examined as to his fitness for ordination. And the presbytery began to give him a bad time, and he responded in kind. Things got a little bit heated. Finally, toward the end of the examination, an elder from the back room got up and directed to the candidate the question which used to be part of the ordination examination. Young man, are you willing to be damned for the glory of God? And he thought a moment, and he said, yes, I am. And what's more, I'd be willing to have this whole presbytery damned for the glory of God. Now, that's almost an introduction to my topic. I've told a story, and it might even have communicated a theological point. What I want to share with you these next 2 days is an arena into which I've found myself moving as somebody who's been classified as a kind of a systematic theologian of sorts. It's been my feeling that theological systems are in bad shape these days. They're not really grabbing people as they once did. And I'm concerned to see what ails our theology and what things could be done to resuscitate the kinds of concerns toward which it points. And it has seemed to me more and more that if theologies or systems are falling on evil days, it's partly because we have been simply systematizing from one another's systems. You want to think through a new statement of the content of our faith, and depending who you are, you might turn to a lot of resources today. You might turn to Tillich or to Barth or back to Schleiermacher, or if that scares you a little, you might go all the way back to Calvin and maybe even try to see what Aquinas or Augustine had to say. We piggyback on systems. The thing I have been discovering, or at least the thesis I'm trying to test, is that systems are derivative. They're a secondary or maybe even tertiary kind of attempt to communicate the faith. that what is basic as a mode of communication of theological truth is story, narrative, and that systems then come along as attempts to reflect upon, give some kind of systematic structure to narrative, to story. Let me give just an instance or two of how this began to become clear for me. In the early days of anti-war concern in this country, as I began to feel more and more that we were doing something terribly immoral in Vietnam, I began to get involved with the little handful of other people who shared that kind of concern, and I had the great fortune, one of the few happy byproducts for me of the Vietnam years, to become very well acquainted with Rabbi Abraham Heschel. Heschel had been a Polish Hasidic Jew who got out of Europe just before Hitler caught up with him. He had seen what happens when people are burned, and he not only did not approve of the burning of Jews in Europe, he did not approve of the burning of Vietnamese peasants in Southeast Asia. I became well acquainted with him, and I remember at one point appealing to him. We called him Father Abraham in the movement, appealing to him for some help. I had this sense that things needed to be done. I felt personally kind of timid. Other people were doing a lot more. Bill Kaufman was miles ahead of where I was. Daniel Berrigan was miles ahead of all of us and so forth. And I remember asking something to say, how do you in the Jewish tradition handle this problem of a sense of inadequacy, a sense of guilt, and so forth, expecting, I'll get some nice, sweet answer. Heschel looks at me and says, "My friend, let me tell you a story." And he told a story, which I have since heard many times, but to me it was new. He said, when the great Rabbi Sutcher was on his deathbed, he said to his friends how little he had accomplished in his lifetime. Someone asked him if he was afraid of the judgment. And Fisher replied, "Not in the way you think. For when I appear before the throne of the Almighty, I will not be asked, 'Why were you not Moses?' I will only be asked, 'Why were you not Fisher?'" Now that was better than six lectures on personal responsibility, establishing one's own identity, and so forth. I was being told the question I had to face was not, why are you not Daniel Berrigan? Why are you not Bill Kaufman or whatever? I simply had that question turned back to me. I was given the ball in effect and told to run with it myself. I had to be who I was and not someone else. I learned more from that story and the way it was told than I could have learned from a long systematic historical review of different Jewish attitudes toward the question. One other example, this also it's very symbolic that the instances that immediately occur to mind come out of the Jewish tradition, because I think it's a very Jewish way of thinking, the telling of stories, and maybe that's a part of the Christian heritage that we have neglected a little bit, the rootage we had in Judaism out of which we could perhaps draw some of these new resources. This is the story. I don't think I first heard this from Heschel, but it again makes to me a very important point. But the rabbi who is going into the synagogue just before the holy day, before Yom Kippur, before the day of the Day of Atonement, and to prepare himself for this time of abasement, he stands before the ark of the sacred Torah and beats his breast and says, "O God, King of the universe, before your majesty, I am nothing." And the cantor to lead the singing has arrived to get ready for the service, and noticing this, he feels that is appropriate to the mood of the time. So he came up by the rabbi and beat his breast and said, "O Lord God, King of the universe, before your majesty, I am nothing." Point the janitor had come in to clean up for the service, and that seemed an appropriate stance also for him. So he joined them, beat his breast, and said, "O Lord God, King of the universe, before your majesty, I am nothing." At which point the rabbi I nudged the canter and said, look who thinks he's nothing. Now that, again, that tells me a great deal about the problem of humility, about the problem of how we deal with who we are. And to reflect on such a story is for me immensely more useful, I say, than reading a number of tracts or pulling together what X said and what Y said about a certain kind of virtue or lack thereof. So what I'm discovering then is that as we try to communicate what is at the heart of our faith, first of all, we have narrative, and from that we derive a system. It's quite clear, this book, this Bible, is not a book of systematic theology. It tells the story. It tells the Israel story, as that story is then picked up as it concentrates on the life of a particular Jew and then opens out again to the community, the story, the community that grew up around him. It's a classic form of story. It really kind of begins once upon a time in the beginning. And it recounts battles and epics and songs and praise and historical documentary and all the rest. But it is a story. The same thing, I think, is true of the New Testament. Jesus also was not a systematic theologian. He was a teller of tales. I feel a little bit of an echo of this. Somebody asked Jesus a question, in effect said, give me a definition of neighborliness. And Jesus says, in effect, my friend, let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, there was a man who was going from Jerusalem to Jericho. The Gospels don't develop, or they do not give us directly a doctrine of the incarnation. They simply tell the story of a life which incarnated in human form, the reality of God present in our midst. We do not get a lot of systematic theology. Well, maybe Romans is an exception, and a good deal of a letter to the Hebrews. But even by the 11th chapter of Hebrews, as we'll discover tomorrow, the author has slipped into telling a lot of stories. Something happened, and people tried to write about it, to tell us stories about it. Now, I'm not knocking the need to think systematically about those stories. But I think that we might in a much fresher fashion, get a hold of the meaning of our faith for today if we would try to return, first of all, to the story, to the narrative form as it was first communicated. And then maybe a little further down the line, we can begin to systematize about that again in ways that will be important for our own time. I discovered this more and more in my teaching of university students. I give one of these courses on contemporary theologians, a hop, skip, and a jump for undergraduates across the map of contemporary writers from Barth and Bonhoeffer up through Niebuhr, Karl Rahner, Teilhard de Chardin, and so forth, a kind of a theological smorgasbord. But the advantage is that with a great variety, somebody can always find someone with whom really to become engaged. And I discovered each year that as I was dealing with the thought of these theologians, I was spending more time on the life of the theologian. It's going to be more important to get a hold of who the person was, the circumstances out of which the person theologized, if one was really to get a hold of the meaning of the theology. This is, of course, particularly true with someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who wrote a good deal of material that, in one sense or another, can be called systematic, although most of it is in fragmentary form, and then who left us these fragments in his letters and papers in prison, which have to be understood in the light of the personal situation in which he was living, and the story of how someone who was a very bourgeois, sort of upper trust, part of Berlin society, lived in a lovely home where they always had four or five servants, had a very clearly marked out, brilliant academic career facing him. The story of how such a one as that ended up in the underground resistance, leading a double life as a kind of a double agent, engaged in the plot against Hitler's life, the story of that transformation, which can only be understood in the way in which the biblical faith gripped and got a hold of Bonhoeffer, that's a crucial part of understanding the more reflective thinking in which Bonhoeffer engaged. So to go from narrative to systematic reflection seems an important way for us to go. Let me just give one other example of the different levels of this kind of communication. Let me take an example from a slightly different arena and then try to apply to this problem I'm trying this morning in a preliminary way to open up. This would be familiar to any of you who are railroad buffs, which I have never been. But several years ago, my wife and I had a chance to do a little traveling in Switzerland, and to facilitate getting around, I bought a complete timetable that listed every train and bus and boat in the entire transportation system of that country. Unfortunately, it's a small country, so you could get this whole thing in your pocket. It was called, for reasons that never became clear to me, a FRIBO, F-R-I-B-O. And I had a very exciting time with this FRIBO, putting all these different timetables and connections together. I could sit in the station at Tours and sit there and predict that the afternoon Glacier Express coming in from Zermatt was going to come around the bend of track 8 in exactly 2 minutes, and sure enough, it would. And the next morning I could sit in the carriage of that same train as it was starting back to Zermatt, due to leave at 09:06, and be confident that 08:58, the train from Arosa would come in on the other side of the station, and passengers would be tumbling out of that and across to get the Zermatt Express in the 6 minute connection time that they had. I could work out all kinds of fascinating ways to get from here to there, and was intrigued with the way in which this little instrument made me privy to all kinds of information about the Swiss railway system. And yet, of course, that didn't really tell me anything important about traveling in Switzerland. The FRIBO view of Swiss travel was literally flat and two-dimensional. It could tell me that I would get to Andermatt at 14:23, but it couldn't tell me anything about the thrilling ride down into that village as the train went over the span of immense ravines, went through tunnels, doubled back on itself, as the little engine in front sometimes had to go on the cog railway thing to keep from slipping down too fast. The FRIBO could tell me that I could get a train into Bern at 15:35, but it could tell me nothing of the ecstatic greetings on the station platform as people were reunited and so forth. It seems to me that the discipline of theology is a little bit like the FRIBO, and the narrative form is a little bit like the actual flesh and blood experiences that people have when they travel on the railway system, which the FRIBO tells us about. And the excitement, the immediacy, the dynamic of the human reality of travel in Switzerland is to me somewhat analogous to the excitement, the dynamic, the telling of a story. And the less exciting but important systematizing of that whole human experience of travel that comes in the railway timetable is to me a little bit like the task of systematic theology. You need them both, but the railway timetable is only important as it tells us something about the experience that's going on out there, just as the theologizing, the systematizing is important only as it in some way points us toward the exciting reality of the encounter between God and ourselves, which in its very nature is going to come in this narrative story form. Those are some of the kinds of reflections then which have led me to want to look a little more closely at the kind of things that characterize stories and storytelling. And out of many of those kinds of reflections in which one could engage, let me, for the rest of this time, just indicate a few kinds of characteristics of stories that seem to me useful in our attempt to begin a new approach to theologizing. One thing that seems important in thinking about stories is to remember a very obvious fact we often forget, that they originally come to us in oral form. They are told. Later on, they may be written down. But there's something very important in the power of oral, of speech, as it comes to us directly in that form. In the old tradition of Scotland, of which I trace my forebears back, there was a character who was very important for a long time in Scottish history, the Chanticle. Now, if I wince a little bit over that pronunciation, it's because this is a Gaelic term which I don't feel too confident about. You may understand the degree of my trepidation when I tell you that the word in Gaelic is spelled S-E-N-A-C-H-A-I-D-H, Chanticle, I think. At all events, the Chanticle was the one who fulfilled this role. Morris West, in his fascinating novel of the Scottish, laid out in the Hebrides, Summer of the Red Wolf, has one of his characters tell the narrator in the novel about a Chanticle. He says, a Chanticle is a storyteller like you, though not quite like, because he keeps everything in his head. The histories of the clans that go way back, the fairy tales of the time before the clans, the histories that hang around the place names. Sometimes he's a bard too and can sing you the old songs or make you a new poem for a wedding or a funeral. Chanticle was a teller of tales, a recorder of the tales from the past. He drew them out of ancient experience. He pulled together in narrative fashion the traditions of the tribes, the clans, and all the rest. He dealt with the past to tell the past in ways important to the present, and he did it in this oral form. He did not write it down. He could therefore adapt. Here is a wedding, and telling the old story, he can somehow incorporate something about the bride and the bridegroom or the families of those there. A creative confrontation in story form. And something of that power of speech, I think we need to see as at the basis of how we communicate our theological convictions. Martin Buber, as you know, not only wrote I and Thou and many books about the Hasidim, he also started a venture with his friend Franz Rosenzweig that Buber completed after Rosenzweig's death of translating the Hebrew scriptures into German, a task to which he gave many years. When that translation was published, there was a little presentation ceremony in Jerusalem, and Gershom Scholem tried to indicate to Buber what he thought was the most distinctive thing about that translation. And he felt that it was Buber's stress on Sprachdenken, the centrality of speech, that the most important thing Buber had done, well, let me put it in Scholem's words, because I think it's very appropriate to our subject today. Scholem said to Buber, I became aware that what mattered to you in your translation was the spoken word. You were not interested in translating the Bible as literature. Not the literary quality was important to you, not that the reader could pick up with his eyes, but the realm of the living spoken word. It is a unique feature of your translation that it uses every means to force the reader to read the text aloud. The biblical word as spoken word, as recitative, was always before your eyes, or rather, before your ears. So it's the quality then of story as it is told and listened to before it is written and read. And Buber, as Scholem indicates, was trying to get that basic quality of the power of speech in such a way that it might live again for those who are themselves separated from the original speech and could have it transmitted to them only through the written word. So this power of speech, as it comes to us when we hear a story, is absolutely crucial. And this, I think, surely we can say was also at the heart of what happened at the very beginnings of the Christian faith. Amos Wilder, in commenting on these themes in his book, Early Christian Rhetoric, and it says, Jesus was a voice, not a penman. Says Jesus confined himself to the spoken and precarious word, did not write books. Now, pretty soon, of course, the stories, the information had to begin to be written down. But how significant, how theologically significant, that it was written down not in classical Greek with polished literary forms to be read and heard and looked at for the majesty of style and so forth. No, written in this ordinary, down-to-earth, marketplace, garden variety of Koine Greek, the language of ordinary people, not the language of those involved with polished literature. Again, something that could communicate in the most direct way through the power of the spoken word, not something that is dependent upon the power of very crafted literary kind of production. So one thing then the story does is put us back in touch with the power of speech, and that speech has an ability to change lives, to create new situations. We can hear speech that absolutely transforms where we before have been. Just a couple of quick examples of this. One can hear a statement, the governor has granted you a reprieve. That bit of information coming to somebody on death row, you can imagine the power that that speech has to transform life. Someone else says, I, John, take you, Mary, to be my wedded wife. Not this time information, but prompts, and a totally new situation is created. Or someone else says, as was said on one famous American occasion of the past, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. A command is given, and the whole situation of everyone on that ship and even in that huge naval battle is transformed. The power of speech to transform. And our task, I think, when we're dealing with the literary records, is to see if there are not ways in which some of that power cannot be recaptured, so that we can live again through the story and hear its impact for us right here and now. Once again, there can be information and promises and commands. This time, maybe the information is that God forgives you or Jesus Christ died for you, can be utterly transforming. Or the promise, I will be your God and you will be my people. Or the command, maybe not this time, damn the torpedoes, but something like, love your enemies. The power of speech, the need to enter into that as something we can internalize for our own experience. This is a very important characteristic of the power of the storytelling form. The second thing that I think, beyond this evocative power of speech, of oral communication, is important, is that to tell stories tells something very important about who we are. It says that we are, secondly, communal beings. A story always implies a community. There has to be a listener as well as a teller. You tell a story to someone else. Now, you can tell a story just to yourself, but if you do that too much, they're going to begin to put you in some place where you'll be safe from others. We cannot simply talk to ourselves in an internal monologue. There must be this engagement. To speak it all to another, to tell a story, is to acknowledge the importance, the essential importance of the other. And it is to do this at real risk. If I tell a story to you, if I tell my story to you, I'm saying, in effect, look, I can't really be who I am apart from you. Only if you'll listen to me can the fullness of who I am be expressed. And to hear the story is also to acknowledge the importance, the essential importance of the other. The listener, in effect, is saying, I acknowledge you. I'll turn away from what I'm doing now, what I might otherwise do, in order that I can listen to you. So each acknowledges the crucial importance of the other, and each does so at risk. The teller risks the pain of the listener's rebuff, or even worse, disinterest. The listener might in fact say, your story bores me. You may have seen that remarkable episode in Ingmar Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage, in which the husband and the wife are having a very difficult time relating to one another. The wife has been getting some psychiatric help, and she's been encouraged to keep a journal. And in a rather tense scene, she says to the husband, if you'll just let me read what's in the journal, you'll have a better idea of who I am, where I'm coming from. So he agrees, and she starts in reading, and she gets very absorbed in what she's reading, and she pours her heart out to him in this way. At the end of it, she looks up to the page, and he's fallen asleep. No more devastating put-down could be possible. One shares one's story at great risk, but one also hears a story at great risk, because I can hear another story, and I might have to respond because of what I have heard. I can no longer remain the way I was. Until a few moments ago, my ways were set, but now you have overturned my universe. This is the risk that is sometimes described as conversion, being turned around by some new reality that I cannot avoid. Now, it seems to me that there are a number of ways, then, in which the telling of stories and the listening to stories deals with the communal nature of our being. I think of at least four kinds of relationships which spell out the different kinds of community. Maybe there are more, but let me try these briefly on you. Sometimes the teller and the hearer are both in need. I tell out of need, you hear out of need. I think that's probably the usual human condition. We're neither of us fulfilled. We hope for something new, which can come by giving and receiving. Second possible relationship would be that the teller of the tale is fulfilled, at least relatively fulfilled, and speaks out of that to the need of the hearer. This would, I suppose, be the situation of trying to communicate the gospel. Here is good news, to which in some way or other I feel myself caught up so much that I must share it with the one who has not experienced that or appropriated that. Out of some kind of at least partial fulfillment, I seek to share with the hearer in need. The third relation could be just the opposite. The one who tells is the one in need, and that person hopes for fulfillment from the one who listens. That would be the psychiatric experience. I tell my story to the psychiatrist because my story is an unfulfilling, unsatisfying, disjointed, destructive story. And I hope that speaking out of need, I may be given more fulfillment from the one who hears. Or a fourth kind of communal relationship could be that the teller and the hearer are both, in some sense, fulfilled and are trying to share that reality to fortify an ongoing commitment, an ongoing fulfillment. That would be ideally the situation when we engage in liturgy, that we gather together, we hear together a story to which we all relate. And in the hearing of that story as community, and in the sharing of the meaning of that story as community, we are enriched and fortified to act out more fully the implications of that story. So that's a second kind of characteristic of stories and storytelling. They exemplify the communal dimension of our existence. Now, a third thing that I think is very important is what I'll call the like-unlike rubric. That is to say that to engage us, a story must be something like our story, but not too much. If the story is not like my story at all, there's really no way I can relate to it. I find no point of contact with it, and I'll be increasingly frustrated in attempts to understand it. You hear a story start with the words, "But Brillig and the Slithy Toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe." And that may be good as an attention getter, but if the story went on like that for 15 or 20 minutes, you'd tune out pretty quickly. There wouldn't be enough likeness to relate to it. So the story can't be too dissimilar. On the other hand, the story must not be too similar, or I'll simply get bored. If I can anticipate every twist and turn in the story, that will soon fail to captivate me. And I'll be frustrated again, not this time because I can't understand it, but because it's so drearily familiar. So there must be a mixture of similarity and dissimilarity. This is one of the great charms, I think, of the trilogy, the quest story of J.R.R. Tolkien, the Fellowship of the Ring, which I'm going to talk about a little bit tomorrow. Tolkien has created an entire universe. He takes us into what's called Middle Earth. Middle Earth is different enough from our Earth to make us wonder what's going to happen. It's enough like our Earth so that we're not completely strangers in it. One commentator on this fact says this is the great achievement of Tolkien in this imaginative three-volume creation. He says, "The reader walks through any Middle Earth landscape with the security of recognition that woos him on to believe in anything that happens. Familiar but not too familiar. Strange but not too strange." This is the master rubric that Tolkien bears in mind when inventing the world of his epic. In other words, a story must reach me on some level to which I can respond, but it must also stretch me. It must pull me beyond where I now am, opening up some new door to my mind or my heart, so that I become an increasingly willing listener. Now that has to happen, I think, whether it's a Tolkien story or an Aeschylus story or part of the Israel Christian story. And perhaps part of the way we could recover vitality for the Israel Christian story in our time would be to dwell on and deal in our telling of it with this expected, unexpected, like, unlike, similar, dissimilar kind of rubric. There's a lot of that story with which we can identify. We know about the lives of peoples, even in different cultures. We know about the temptations of human nature and so forth. We know that people long for a leader in this story for the coming of the king. But nobody with any stretch of the imagination ever was able to anticipate that in this story, when the king came, the king would come as a servant. That bowls us over. It ought to bowl us over. It doesn't really very much because we've gotten used to it, but it bowled over the disciples. Just read Matthew 16 again if you have any doubts about that. So there is this sense of the importance of likeness and unlikeness a sense of the importance that within a familiar arena, something unfamiliar happens, that the unexpected intrudes in such a way that we do have to be transformed if we're to take it seriously. Just one other example of this out of the Tolkien trilogy, which I know some of you must be familiar with. It's a huge, vast epic, full of battles, the clang of armor, kings, strategies, all the rest, galloping hoofs, trumpets. But all that which is attracting attention is not the arena in which the most important thing is happening. C.S. Lewis says in describing this, far away from all the battles, two miserable creatures creep like mice in a flag heap through the twilight of Mordor. And all the time we know that the fate of the world depends more on their small movements than on the great movements. Two little tiny hobbits who have to get rid of a ring, and the fate of Middle-earth depends on that. How unexpected that in the minuscule, unspectacular movement, the most important things in the story would be happening. That again, I think, is an entree into the Israel story. Who would have expected that Yahweh would choose this nation as the vehicle through which his word would be proclaimed? It surely ought to have been one of those great empires, Babylonia, Greece, Assyria, Roman Empire, or whatever. Israel is weak. Through that, the message will come. In these terms, Jesus is a nobody. Not the one one would have expected in the first century to be the vehicle through which God would work a mighty redemptive act. That's not heretical. That's very biblical. I mean, God chooses the weak things in this world to confound the proud and so forth. The king comes as a servant. Dorothy Sayers has a marvelous little one-act nativity play in which all kinds of bustle and things are going on outside this inn. All the important things are happening and the engagement between people, the soldiers that come in, the guests that come and so forth. But we know in some dim way that the really important thing is that unimportant little event that somehow, after a while, is a baby cry and somebody has been born. Well, within the framework of the expected, it's the unexpected that gives power to the story. Now, I want to make just one final comment on that unexpected theme, because I think it's crucial to understanding stories and also to understanding the power of the Israel Christian story. This is that the importance of the unexpected can still be real, even though we in fact know what's going to happen. It is not so much the fact of the unexpectedness, but the quality of the unexpectedness. I've had the effectiveness and experience over many years of telling stories to our children. What stories do they like? They like the stories they know best. And the fact that they know how it's going to come out does not diminish by one iota the power of the story. It enhances it. Sometime again, when you tell for the 10th time to your children the story of Peter Rabbit, remember how the eyes get larger and there's anticipation when you get to that point. And when round the edge of the cucumber frame, who should appear but, and if you don't say it, they'll come out with it, Mr. McGregor. Living through that exciting encounter again is very crucial. And that seems to me maybe a little bit of a help into the story of the Christian years, the liturgical life through which we live each year. We know the story, we've heard it before, but we live through it. And it helps Easter not to be a cheap answer too quickly given to pain, that we have to live through 40 days of Lent before we get there. The story is familiar. The unexpectedness comes in, but it is the quality of that unexpectedness that always can grab, transform, and in the best sense of the word, enchant us once again. These are some of the kinds of things, then, that stories can do to help us get in to a fresh appraisal of the Christian story. What I want to do the next 2 days is to take two literary genres, the genre of the quest story as a way back into the concern for community and the meaning of the church, and then in what may seem a dubious venture, but I want to give it a try, the fairy story as a way of raising the issues with which eschatology deals. So we'll try a couple of case studies on this relation of other stories to the story, and then on Friday try to wrap some of that up in some conclusions about how we make another story our own. I appreciate being here. I look forward to the chance to engage with you, and thank you for your attention this morning.
Almighty God, who has history as thine own story, and who in our hearts is telling yet the unfinished story, be with us and our time and all mankind through this day and all the days.